Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And it's a cold, blustery day again.
Do you like snow?
I'm getting
utterly sick of snow and ice.
I've read the forecast, and they say we're going to be miserably cold through into April.
It's that damn groundhog just down the road from here. We are not to blame, listeners. Punxsutawney Phil is only about 50 miles away, but we are not to blame.
Right.
For what he chooses to do. It's all in the handlers and whatever it is they're selling. And in the meantime, of course, On the Menu keeps on chugging along, and we're here with you again today with a mixed bag.
Yeah, that's what I was going to call it.
Okay, so that's what it is, a mixed bag. So wait until you hear what's in the bag next.
I guess the longer you're in this industry, the more likely you are to start crossing and crossing paths with them.
There's no question about
yeah.
that.
Yeah. So, I mean, our next guest, I think I explained, we've been at three of his restaurants.
And he got two Michelin stars at every one of them.
Yeah, and he's about to move on.
And he was the guy responsible. In fact, his lady's posting at Gidley Park in England's beautiful Devon countryside. The founding chef, Michael Caine, went off and did something else. Michael Wignall came in and took over from him. Michelin deducted
a
star.
And then gave it right back.
The very next year he got it right back again. So, this guy's a man of real talent, but a very modest young man, as you'll hear when you listen to the interview.
You know, moving around is what chefs do all over the world. It's the same. This particular chef now, a two-star, we call him Mr. Two-Star, Michael Wignall. We've eaten your food in three different places, I think, right?
Yeah, that's correct, yeah. The
most recent one was Gidley Park, which we've gone to for years and years and years. And you're about to move on onto your own venture. Let's start by, like, when did we first meet?
Oh, God, it was a long time ago. I'm trying to think where it was. I mean, you came to Park.
It was the Devonshire Arms.
Yeah, in the Devonshire Arms. And actually, I've just come back from being there as well, because I haven't been back for about 10 years. And I took my wife, because she's never been to Yorkshire before. She's actually from Wales. So we went on a bit of a gastronomic tour around Yorkshire and Lancashire, which was lovely.
Yeah, and how's she doing? I mean, the restaurant doing?
Yeah, I think it's great. I mean, at the moment, the Devonshire Arms, it's closed at the moment for a refurb, but it's always nice to go back to places that you sort of started from at a younger age to see how they've developed, and, you know, you do miss a certain part of them. Obviously, in your career, you move on and you sort of tend not to look back, but it's great to go back and look at those places that sort of molded your career, if you will.
Yeah, I remember they were very high on you when we went to visit with you, and they underestimated. But the thing that I remember about the Devonshire Arms was the most fascinating was that they had a vertical of Screaming Eagle, which is a wine most Americans can't even find.
That's true. I forgot about that.
Well, when I started at the Devonshire Arms, they didn't have a star or anything, and it was owned by the old Duke and Duchess that were now the Dower Duchess. And I remember saying to them, you know, if I make you a star, I want to go and eat at the French Laundry. And they didn't know where it was, but they said, yeah, that's fine. And obviously, when I got them the star 6 months later, they thought it was a restaurant in the UK. And when they found out it was in California, I got a fantastic first-class trip there. And we did all the we got invited to Opus One. We did cake bread, and we had a sort of sit-down meal with Jack Cakebread when he was still alive. And we went to all the top. We went to Ridge as well, and it was just an amazing, I'll never ever forget that. I think that's my most memorable star, actually, coming to California and all around the wine region and everything. Well, it was stunning.
Well, you went to some great places.
Yeah.
it's funny, on this trip, I can't remember the name of the place now, we went to the Rothschild estate in Oxfordshire, and they told us there about the various different ventures that the Rothschild family had been in, and I didn't realize that Opus One, made in California, was one of their wines. I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, they sent their sort of chief winemaker over to assist them, but it is part of the Rothschilds family. Yeah, it's obviously a stunning wine as well.
Yes.
So anyway, you moved on and you decided the nation's capital was calling. So the next place was it Pennyhill Park was the name of the property, and the restaurant was it Latimer?
Yeah, it was renamed Michael Wiggill at the Latimer, and so I started there in November, and then so we had to wait because we'd obviously missed the guides that year. So then the following year we got a star, and then the following year after that, I mean, you don't have the AA system in the States, but we got up to 4 rosettes, and you can only go up to 5, and then we went up to 5 rosettes, and we got the second star 4 years later. So that was great, and I was spent 8 years of my career there. And
the thing I remember, yeah. Michael, was you told us we interviewed you. I didn't remember.
Really? You know what I remember?
And then I said, well, boy, I know the food's going to be good now, and it sure was.
That manager was very snooty. Do you remember that?
Was he very snooty?
He was snooty, yes.
Well, he didn't realize we were connected.
Oh, right. Yeah, I think was he an English chap or a French chap?
French, I think.
I think.
Oh, yeah, well.
what are you going to say? Now, you just recently left Gidley, but how many years were you there?
Gidley Park.
I was just there 2 years, so I went there. I took over from Michael Caine's. And to be honest, you know, I brought my family down here, and I brought 12 of my team down, so all my kitchen team came with me and a couple from front of house, and I thought, you know, it was going to be, you know, my last sort of position and going to settle down here and everything, and I was quite happy, but, you know, things happen and things like that, and obviously we got 2 stars in a record time. No one else has got it so quick, so we got 2 stars back in 9 months' time, and we were the quickest ever to go to 5 rosettes, and no one's done that so quick, so it was a great achievement for all my team. And then this just came about, partnering up with a really good friend of mine. So I don't know, I thought long and hard about it and thought, this, you know, it probably is the time to have someone on my own, and I'm only accountable for my own actions rather than sort of someone else telling me what to do and things like that. I can build a business how I want it to be, and the experience how I want the guests to experience it, really, and the food as well.
Now, is this a friend? Is this an investor or a chef friend or what?
No, it's a really good friend. It's a really good friend of mine. It's actually my daughter's godparent as well, and we go back a long, long time. And
okay,
you know, his business has grown really, really big, and you know, I've been sort of a little bit of a part of that, and it's just, you know, I never thought he'd go in partnership with me, and we sort of laughed and joked about it on skiing holidays. But it's finally come to fruition, and I think it's a great time in my career to do that. You know, it's the final sort of part of my of what, you know, I want to do, really.
Now, will the food be any different? I mean, I think
wherever I go, you know, wherever you go as a chef, you change from to your environment, and you know, the produce change, whatever part of the country you're in, and you know,
you're talking about going back north, which is where you're originally from. Tell us about that. Where north?
Well, possibly either Yorkshire Dale, North Yorkshire Dales, maybe the Ribble Valley, or possibly the Lake District. You know, we're looking at a few different properties there, and it'll take time. I mean, we might find somewhere in the next few months. It might take 12 months, but I don't want to rush it. You know, it's got to be the right, the right property in the right location. It's got to tick all the boxes as well.
Yeah. Now, what is your vision? I mean, you mentioned rooms, so you like the idea of having the restaurant with rooms, right?
Yeah, I think really, especially in the UK, to make a restaurant pay and survive, you know, I think you've got to have that extra revenue. I don't really want to go into a hotel environment anymore. but, you know, a restaurant that's open 5 days a week with, you know, 8 or 10 rooms, it's just a guaranteed, and especially now as well, it's a guaranteed revenue, and especially now with, you know, no one wants to drive and have a drink
that's
and things.
True.
So, you know, if you've got, you know, if you've got the facility to where they can sleep as well, you know, and you can do packages and things like that, it just makes the whole thing a lot more.
Yeah, of course, that's what we had at Long Cloom, where we've been going for years, I guess, and we just recently went again in July, and, I mean, he's like bought up the whole town, I mean, the whole village.
Yeah, he has, and, you know, I want to do something similar to that, you know, in a really small village like that, you know, maybe the facility to have, you know, like a chef's table in one part that you run, you know, so it's not fine dining all the time. Maybe just do really good, you know, maybe one star food, you know, but all to that standard, but a little bit more homely. But then also the facility to do 3 or 4 days a week in a separate room or a separate annex, you know, maybe a chef's table for 8 or 10 people where you do a set menu and it's, you know, you really go to town on it.
Now,
and that way, you know, your revenue's coming in both places.
Will you have a farm too? That's a big thing for us.
Everybody's doing a farm.
Well, it's a big thing for Simon. I mean, he has a sizable property.
Yeah, he does. I mean, that'd be, in an ideal world, that'd be fantastic. You know, that Yorkshire's full of fantastic producers and growers anyway, but it'd be great to have, you know, I'd like to have at least a kitchen garden or a farm would be fantastic. And then, you know, you're a little bit more self-sufficient as well, especially with these days, you know, the cost of ingredients is going through the roof. So if you can grow them yourself, you can dictate the quality and when you want to pick them, as well as the, you know, how big you want to grow your livestock as well. You know, it's all your control.
You're going to do all that. That's all in addition to rhubarb. You've got to have a lot of rhubarb.
Well, yeah, and especially in Yorkshire. I mean, it's just basically coming into season as we speak, you know.
It is, yes.
The Forced Yorkshire rhubarb is definitely the best in the world. And
I've told chefs from around the world
About the rhubarb triangle.
I think I even told Thomas Keller from the French Laundry about the rhubarb triangle. And I never realized that growing up I must have crossed the rhubarb triangle by train on dozens and dozens of occasions, because it was right between Huddersfield and Leeds where the train
was. Yeah, yeah.
Well, listen here, Michael. Our listeners like to know in detail, in lurid detail, about the food itself. What will be your vision for this new place in terms of your cooking style, the food you want to present? You already said you want to have a one level and then a higher level, more sophisticated, I guess. But for people who don't know, have never had your cooking, what can you tell us about it?
Yeah, tell us what we're going to eat when we come, when you open.
Well, at the moment, I mean, you've had it a few times. It's quite, you know, it's quite technical. There's a lot of flavors, but everything's, you know, on the plate for a reason. Nothing's jostling for position on your tongue. You know, everything's put on the plate for a reason. Nothing overcomplicates one another. The most important thing for me is the quality of the ingredients and tasting every ingredient each one.
Yeah, and I mean, it's very complex. I mean, the flavors are really multidimensional.
Yeah, I want to go out somewhere and dine and be intrigued of, you know, the flavors and things and the combinations, but, you know, also, you know, everything complements, so you're not thinking, gosh, you know, why is that on the plate? I don't get that. But, you know, you should be sort of intrigued, and you pay a lot of money for food when you go out, and I don't want to go somewhere and look at something and think, gosh, you know, my mother could do, you know, that's like my mother's cooking or whatever, and my mother, you know, two or three things on the plate when you're paying hundreds of pounds for something. You want to go out and be like, wow, you know, how's the chef done that? And, you know, I want to ask him how he's done that and how has he created that. And it should be, the whole process should be a journey, you know, it's from the service staff to the food on the plate and the crockery and just everything. You know, it's not just about dining out, just isn't about the food. It's about the whole experience. And that's really important to me.
Now, there's been a bit of a pushback these days here in the United States against what people are calling tweezer food.
Yeah,
now,
sure.
You draw a fine line between really wonderful technical food, but at the same time, it's not quite tweezer. Thank goodness.
No, not at all. I mean, you know, everyone's got their own style of food, and I think if we all followed the same trend, it'd be pretty boring because everyone would be doing weak copies of one another. But you've got to think long and hard about. Obviously, you know, it's got to look nice on the plate, but the most important thing is the taste and the quality and the way you've cooked it, and but without over fussing over it as well. You know, it's everything's got to be put on the plate for a reason, but not you can't. You know, it's got to be simple, but it's got to be challenging as well. That you know, if you're putting things on a plate with tweezers and it's taking you 10 minutes to put that dish on together. You know, A, it's not going to be hot enough if it's going to be a hot dish anyway, and people don't like things anymore. They're over fussy. You know, but you've also got to stay true to your own beliefs as a chef as well. You know, I mean, people dictate all the time what they'd like to see on a plate. You've just got to stick by your guns, really.
Oh, yeah. Now with everybody making special demands, they're allergic to this, and they're you know, intolerant of that, or I don't know how chefs manage, to tell you the truth.
Well,
yeah, it's that's probably the most I would say demanding thing about being a chef at the moment. It's just, you know, I mean, everyone, every chef that's worth his salt will go out and bend over backwards for dietary requirements, and obviously allergens are taken really, really seriously. But you know, it's come to the stage now where you'll do a 50-cover dinner. And, you know, say 25 checks, and 20 of the checks that are on, the orders that are on, will have a dietary requirement on it. And people just don't think they realize how much extra work it takes. So if you've got a vegan in, that's great, you know, and we cater for vegans, vegetarians, and all sorts. But then when you go out of your way and make a 10-course tasting menu that's purely vegan, and then halfway through the meal they ask for butter with the bread, or you think, oh my gosh, I've just wasted 16 hours preparing a completely bespoke menu for you, and then you've decided that you want butter, or you're all right with a little bit of cream or something. And it spoils it for the people that actually are, you know, strict with the diets, or, you know, with their allergies. It's people have got to stop listening to what you read in the newspaper.
We're with you. We're about the most unvegan couple you can imagine.
I mean,
we're carnivores and proud of it.
But tell me this, Michael. We were talking before. Everything really throughout England, and it's actually true of the United States too, is an unusual state of flux. For various reasons, a shortage of kitchen staffing or restaurant staffing, but you're facing a really big issue in England, in the UK, period, with this whole Brexit thing. What's going to happen? Is there fallout from this?
I think the main thing with Brexit is there's just so much uncertainty, and obviously the price of things has gone up dramatically in the last year and a half since it all started to happen. You know, on average, it's gone up 20-30% on food items because obviously the pound's weak and then the euro's strong, so the imports on food, which, you know, a lot of things are imported, goes up, so that the costs go up dramatically. I mean, you can't put that onto the customer. Say, for instance, you know, butter, with China opening its gates to being able to accept dairy and things like that, the butter's just gone through the roof.
Really?
You know, well, 12 months ago, you'd pay 38-42 English pound for a box of butter, and now you're paying 78-82 pounds.
Wow.
And that's 12 months later, you know, and that's just on butter. So you know, you can't put that onto the price of your menu. So you've just got to be a little bit more savvy with the things you use, without, you know, the detriment of your ingredients that you're using. So it's making you think a lot more. It is affecting things, and obviously then we've got the minimum wage has just been put up because of the government, and then you've got other things like, you know, people can't work, you know, the time directive, so you can't work over 42 hours, or you go under the minimum wage if you, you know, especially commie chefs and things. So then you've got a commis chef that used to be on £17,000 that now has to be paid for every hour over 42 hours. It's, you know, it works out that he's on £6,000 a year. So
amazing. Really amazing. Scary,
it's
actually.
It's really scary. The only thing that's going to happen is, you know, people are just going to cut down on the amount of people in the kitchen because, A, because there isn't the people around, and, B, they can't afford to have that many people in a brigade anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So the only thing, you know, then they're going to start buying things in that are, you know, processed vegetables and things like that, or peeled vegetables or prepared things, or, you know, the fish is then filleted instead of being a whole fish, and the meat's, the butchery's been done, and it's just taking that skill level away. So, you know, I think it's going to be a worrying time for catering, especially over the next five to 10 years.
Well, I wish you luck, and I can't wait to find out where you land, because we'll be there. We have to keep up this record of meeting you and tasting your food at every location. Okay.
Well, we'll look forward to welcoming you again at the next and the final location.
Yeah.
Great, Michael. Well, thank you so much for joining us. We're so glad we had the opportunity to have a farewell meal with you just a couple of weeks ago.
Yes.
And
we loved it, and so did Peter's brother and sister-in-law.
Yes.
Everybody loved it.
Oh,
we'll be ready for
it. We loved having you. It was an honor to see you again. It's always lovely to see
you.
Super,
Michael. So the very best of luck. And regards to your business partner and to your family.
Thank you so much, Peter. Thank you, Anne.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
And we're just going to take a short break, so don't go away for too long.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Our next guest was an amazing surprise, actually. I mean, we knew his products, the Caravelli cheeses, were fabulous. But who knew that Sid Cook, our guest, actually...
Would be such a wonderful spokesperson.
Oh, my goodness. He's funny. He's witty. He's genius, creative. I mean, about the creating the cheeses and also the names he gave the cheeses, which he'll have to explain that to you.
It's a fascinating thing. Unless you know the United States really well, you probably don't realize just how diverse and how really brilliant the agricultural scene is in terms of crops grown and things made. But in that place called Wisconsin, boy, they sure know how to make cheese.
They sure do. He tells us it's everything, the
and
climate.
Sid's one of the leaders and fifth generation at it, and then another generation in the wings. These people are going to go on forever and just keep on inventing wonderful, exciting new flavors of cheese.
Well, I found out about Caravelli cheese because the cheese company won some big award, and, you know, and we love cheese. And we're excited. We have now the Caravelli cheese fourth generation cheesemaker, Sid Cook, on the line talking to us about what makes Caravelli cheese so special. Tell us a little bit about the area, Sid. Wisconsin is known for cheese making, and you started explaining to me about why that was so. You have a lot of milk, right?
Yes. Well, many settlers came here from Germany, from Great Britain. They came from Switzerland, and they came for the land and the timber. And once the land was cleared, they grew wheat, and they, of course, sold the lumber and trapped for animal skins early on. But the people that came and homesteaded had to make a living. And once the soils were depleted and they couldn't grow wheat, year after year after year, they bought cattle, and they started dairying, and small cheese factories grew up, and there were people that lived amongst them that had made cheese back in their home country, and so at one time, about every 6 miles, there was a cheese factory.
Cooks started out their cheese factory, what year was it? A long time ago, right?
Well, in 1883, one of my mother's relatives was a Lepley, and he started making cheese for someone else. He was 13, 14 years old.
And, wow.
and needed a job. People started pretty young then. And the cheesemaker got sick, and so he ended up taking over for the cheesemaker, and he was able to make good cheese and buy a factory, and then his nephews and children got into the cheese business, and so at one time I had two uncles that each had a cheese factory. My grandmother and grandfather had a cheese factory, my great-great aunt and uncles. Two uncles and an aunt each had a cheese factory, and so it became a family profession. And then when my parents were married in 1936, my father stayed on the farm with his dad for about 7 or 8 years, and then decided that he would get into the cheese business with my mother's brothers. So he learned to make cheese out west of Broca, Wisconsin, at a little crossroad town called Bud, B-U-D. And my Uncle Floyd Burt owned that factory with his brother Derwood. And he did an apprenticeship there for about 6 months, got his cheesemaker's license, and then stayed another year before he found a factory to buy northwest of Madison, near Plain. And the name of that cheese factory was Irish Valley. And he made cheese there until 1976. At that time, he sold the plant to my brother and I. We both made cheese there for 10 years, 8 or 9, 10 years, and then I bought the factory at Carr Valley.
Now, you're amazing. You're were different than a lot of cheese people in that you don't produce any milk. You have cheese factories and you buy your milk from other people.
Right, we buy our milk from about 25 local farms, cow milk farms that have shipped. Many of them have shipped milk to us for 3 and 4 generations to the factory, so we've had a relationship with them for many, many years. And then we also buy milk from some sheep milk farms. We have 3 sheep milk farms, and we have a goat milk farm, and then that we buy from, and the rest of the milk we buy from local cooperatives that have milk to sell us.
Now you've got a very wide variety of different cheeses that you make, and you sent us a lot of them. We haven't tried them all yet. But guess, see if you can guess.
We've been eating cheese 3 times a day.
I absolutely love cheese.
And I love your butter, by the way, because you also make butter.
But there's one kind of cheese that I like the very best, and that's the one we started with. See if you can guess which one it was.
The one that you're eating today.
No, the one we started with.
Yeah. Well, it may be an aged cheddar.
No, it was the Glacier Bay.
Oh,
I love blue cheese.
Yes, yes. Well, we make quite a few blue cheeses. We make more than 100 different cheeses.
My God, how do you keep track of them all?
Well, I'm attention deficit, so it's quite easy. And so we have 4 manufacturing plants. And we have different cheese making systems for making all the different cheeses. And so we, the plant at Laval, Wisconsin, we do all vat salted cheeses. At the plant in Marston, we do all brine salted cheeses at the plant in Linden, Wisconsin. We do all blue cheeses, and then we do our bread cheese at the Fenimore plant.
Yeah, I have to ask you about that. It reminds me a little of mozzarella.
Yeah, I had never had bread cheese before, and it's a little different.
Yeah, well, bread cheese, you want to heat that up. And so if you read the directions on it, you can microwave it, you can saute it, you can deep fry it. But what you want to do is you want to cut that into squares and either saute it or just microwave it for 10 seconds.
You know, I'm going to take a big risk here by telling you what I did with some that you're probably going to be aghast at, is for breakfast. I do breakfast bowls. I don't like cereal, and I don't, you know. So I had, I always, Peter makes me lentils with quinoa. And so I put those in a bowl, and then I had some leftover lamb stew, which was Peter made, which was very good. So I put the juice from that in, and then I cubed up the bread cheese and microwaved it.
Oh, well, that sounds very good.
It was excellent.
Well, the bread cheese is really good, both savory or sweet.
Yeah, I noticed that, yeah.
You know, traditionally, bread cheese was, traditionally the cheese was made in Finland. And they used reindeer milk, and then they would make their cheese and then bake it in a wooden oven. And so today and of course it was raw milk, except that it was baked. But the way we make it, we use cow's milk, and although we do one version with goat milk. And we do that in four flavors. We do chipotle, jalapeno, garlic, and plain. And traditionally, it was used, they would cut it in a stick, and then they would stir their coffee with it in the morning.
Oh, that's interesting.
And warm the cheese up that way, and then eat it, eat it as breakfast. Now, it's really good with honey, maple syrup, any kind of jam or jelly is delicious on it after it's heated. And so there's really lots of ways to eat it. I think the garlic bread cheese is especially good, savory. With like say like a tomato sauce or something like that on it.
So, you sound like a cook as well as a cheesemaker.
Well, if you make 100 different cheeses, you are kind of like a chef. It's just that you only have the ingredients that you have are different kinds of milk, different kinds of cultures, and different types of affinage.
Yeah, well, I thought unusual was the Coco Cardona.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, we like that one a lot.
Yeah, that one is wonderful. It's it's a goat milk cheese that we pre-press. And with that one, we use four different cultures. And then it's a bright white color. And then we add a combination of bleached and unbleached cocoa with a dash of pepper in it to brighten up the flavors.
Wow.
We use the bleach to give it that lovely bright brown color, and we use the unbleached, we like to give it the flavor, and then we just use a little black pepper in it to brighten the flavors and to contrast it with the acidity of the milk.
Now, who invented that? I mean, did you invent that?
Yes, I did.
You make up the interesting cheese combinations, huh?
Well, we call them American originals because, you know, many of us here in the U.S. have European ancestors, and of course many don't, but many of us do. And so, the common cheese types like Emmental and Gruyere and Raclette and Feta and Parmesan, You know, the European Union wants us not to use those names.
Exactly.
Right.
They think those cheeses should only be made in Greece or in Italy or Switzerland. You know, so, you know, after 150 years of marketing for them, they want a monopoly.
Uh-huh. So, yeah, the Greeks made quite a big stink about feta.
Right. And so anyway, my idea is that, you know, we've been here for 200, 300, 400, 500 years, whatever. Why do we want to make their cheeses anyway? We should be making our own by now, I would think.
Right.
The reason that we came here was to get away from them anyway.
Are you familiar with the people at Rogue Creamery in the Northwest?
Oh, sure.
You know how they got their start. Somebody smuggled the rope for pirates. somebody smuggled it into the U.S.
The founder of the Rogue Creamery was the one who's...
Oh, sure.
And then he sold the business to the two young guys. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it may have been the Vella family that started all that.
That's it. Yeah, that's it.
I always really enjoyed Ig. Whenever I was in Sonoma, I always sought him out.
He was a character, I hear.
Oh, yeah. He was a lot of fun. He was kind of a little bit grumpy and a little bit sarcastic, but he was just a blast. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I always enjoyed spending time with him and listening to him. We actually grew up very similar. You know, he grew up in a family. He was very young and spent a lot of time in the factory when he was a very young boy, and of course, so did I. When you opened the kitchen door, the factory was right there in the vats, and I'd ride my tricycle around the vats in the evening and you know, help my dad whenever I could, and it kind of grew up that way, too.
Now, listeners, Sid's being very bashful here. Sid's invented how many American Cheese Society first place cheeses?
Well, I'm not sure how many first places we've won, but we're up to 684 national and international awards.
Only 684.
Yeah, and actually, we don't enter the American Cheese Society contest anymore. I think it's been 2 or 3 years. We only do the world contest.
Yeah.
Yeah, we only do the world contest in Europe.
Okay, got it.
We do the world contest in the United States, and we do the U.S. contest in the United States.
Uh-huh. Now tell me this, when you're thinking about this, what goes through your head as the reason why your cheese is so much better than all these gazillion other cheeses out there?
Well, I think part of it is the terroir. You know, it's like
that's
wine,
true.
And I think that's partly it. It's the area of Wisconsin that we have a lot of limestone in our. In our soils, we have very lush grasses. Sauk County has 20,000 different plants in the county. That's more than the diversity of many states.
Yes,
and so we have a lot of diversity in our pastures. We have, you know, if you look at the map of Wisconsin, the Mississippi River is on the left. Lake Michigan is on the right. Lake Superior, 12% of the world's fresh water, is on the north. We've got the Wisconsin River coming down in the center and the Fox River going up toward Green Bay. And so we have a lot of water here, too. And so I think it's a combination of terroir, and then the other thing we have are some really good cheesemakers here.
Right, so what do you do?
Yeah, we have Standards and Heritage. We have a great center for dairy research here in the state. We have a wonderful Wisconsin Cheesemakers Association that includes membership from cheesemakers from all over the U.S. and all over the world. They can join and be part of it. We get a lot of support from the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. And so there's really a lot going on here in dairy because there's so many people involved in it.
Now you don't go running around with one of those silly cheese head things on your head, do you?
Well, no, but we sure sold them in our stores.
Oh, you do?
So that's one thing that I haven't mentioned is in addition to the factories, we have 8 of our own retail cheese stores.
Okay.
And then they're all, located within about a 50-mile radius of the plants here in south-central Wisconsin. And then as well, we have a great internet store, an online store at carvalleycheese.com. And so we also sell cheese online. And, that way anybody can get it anywhere in the U.S.
Yeah, the hard part is figuring out what you want. There's so many choices.
Yeah, there really are a lot of choices. But, when people are here in Wisconsin, we have a lot of people from out of state that are visitors that come and visit our stores, and we're always sampling product. That's one thing that we do in our stores because so many of the cheeses that we do are American originals. So, we're fine with people if they say, oh, I'd like to taste this or like to taste that. So, and generally we have 5 or 6 cheeses out to sample in the store so people can taste something that they're not familiar with. And then we rotate those all through the week so we have different cheeses out there. So, typically we'll have a sheep milk cheese out, we'll have a goat milk cheese out, we'll have a mixed milk cheese. We're one of the first, if not the first company in the U.S. to make mixed milk cheeses.
What's that?
Sheep milk and cow all mixed up together.
One? Did we have one of those? I can't.
I don't know whether we've opened one of those yet or not. We had the Mobe, which is side by side with ash down the middle.
Yeah, that was clever. Did you think of that one too?
We like that one.
Yep, I made that one.
You're a natural, Sid Cook.
And then there's a French cheese that's made with cow's milk called Morbier.
Oh yes,
yes.
Morbier has the ash in the center,
exactly.
And then it has the bee linens on the outside, so it's one of those cheeses that's a little stinky,
Uh-huh.
So what we did is we did a layer of sheep and a layer of goat with the ash in the center, and then we called it Mobe instead of Morbier.
It's
actually completely different. Years ago, we actually had somebody send me an email and say that it was just the Mobe was just terrible. It wasn't anything like the French Morbier. And I'm like, well, not supposed to be.
Yeah.
So it's a beautiful cheese. What's so lovely about that is you can eat the goat milk side, you can eat the sheep milk side, and then you can eat both together with the ash.
Yes.
And the ash has alkalinity and the cheese has acidity. And it's really a delicious cheese with like a Zinfandel or a wine that has a little bit of smokiness to it.
Let's reassure our listeners around the country, around the world for that matter, that there's another generation of cooks that is going to take over when you finally hang it up?
Well, we have some family in the business. My son is managing the lab. We test all of our cheeses to make sure that the quality is right so that we know what it goes to moisture, pH, fat in the dry matter, salt content, all of those things. And as well, we test the cheese to make sure that Everything is okay with the food safety end of it. And so he manages that, and he's it keeps very busy doing that. And then we have some other family members in the business too. We have a son-in-law and a daughter that does social media.
Uh-huh.
And so anyway, yeah, we you know, we have involved. And then, of course, there's some other families that, local families that are also involved, too. That we have two cheesemakers that are brothers, and Dave has been there for about 57 years, and Les has been there for
He's
about
the one I've been writing to, right, Dave? Is he the one I've been...
No, you've been writing to our sales manager, Dave.
Oh, okay.
He's Dave, my son-in-law.
Okay.
He's got a real easy job, Sid. You can tell him I said so.
Dave loves his job.
He's got an easy job.
Well, he says this is an easy job. It's easy to sell product that tastes great.
Okay.
See, that's exactly what I meant.
Yeah. Well, you seem like you're having a great time as well. And I mean, I don't know if I were making, I don't know, horseshoes or I don't know, igloos, whatever I'd be making, I'd want you to sell them.
Well, you know, cheese making really is a lot of fun. And, you know, we really have been so lucky because we get to make so many different kinds of cheese. You know, there's a lot of cheesemakers and master cheesemakers here in the state that only get to make one or two kinds of cheese. And we've been very, very lucky, and I think our cheesemakers really enjoy the diversity.
Yeah, Uplands, for example. Uplands had one cheese only for a while, and for a long while, and now they have, I think, two?
Yeah.
It's a good cheese, very good cheese, but still.
Oh, yeah, sure. And they do a wonderful job, and they've got some very nice product.
Yeah.
Sid, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, yeah. And we're having a good time talking to you and a good time eating the cheese.
Well, thanks for arranging this interview. I always love to talk about cheese in Wisconsin and what we're doing here. And, I'm so very proud of our company and our cheesemakers, but I'm also very proud of all the other cheesemakers here in Wisconsin that work so hard every day, and as well the dairy farmers that supply the milk, whether it's cow's milk, goat milk, or sheep milk.
Yeah, lots to hear for the farmers, too.
That's
great.
Okay, that's
right. Well, keep up the good work, and Sid, maybe we'll talk to you again soon. Let me know if you're doing something else wild and wonderful.
Well, that sounds good. You enjoy the cheeses that Dave sent,
and
if you find one that you absolutely have to have again, you contact us.
Don't tell Peter that, because he's going to be on his computer ordering it.
Okay.
Thanks, Sid Cook.
You have a great afternoon.
Right. Car Valley Cheese. Thank you.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, there's always something new to report, and this is the new...
Of course there's always something new to report.
Things keep moving along, and here we have now the Bakery Society of Pittsburgh,
TBSP. Sounds kind of like a song.
Sounds like an abbreviation for
R-E-S-P-E-C-T. Who was that lady who sang that? Aretha Franklin, wasn't it?
I don't know
TBSP sounds to me like...
Oh, I thought it was an abbreviation for teaspoon. That's TSP.
Yeah, well, it's not. What is it? What does it stand for?
The Bakery Society.
The Bakery Society of Pittsburgh. And they're up to something quite unusual.
Right. Phil Lank, you have been a culinary arts professor for how many years now?
I've been a professor for 6 years now.
And before that?
Well, before that, I worked in the restaurant business, and before that, I did some investment. I was also a realtor at one time in my life.
Oh, wow. You
so I've had a few different careers that which helped shape what I do now.
Right. Well, because you do a lot of teaching about the business side of restaurants, too.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what we're talking about today is a concept that I really want you to explain it to our listeners, because I'm not so sure. There are so many moving parts. I'm not sure that I grasp the whole thing. But it's the it comes out of the Bakery Society Pittsburgh, which I didn't even know we had. So tell us about that and this program and what's the mission and is this local? Just talk.
Okay, absolutely. I love to talk about this. I've been involved with the Bakery Society of Pittsburgh for about 18 months now. When I was working at the Art Institute, one of our local career people came up and said, hey, this lady's on the phone. She wants to talk to somebody about bakeries. Well, I thought she wanted to get some employees, some of our students, to go work there. I call her up, and she says, oh, I'm with a local government agency. It's called Economic Development South. It's in the South Hills of Pittsburgh. They try and revitalize community. They'll do everything from installing new sidewalks, you know, funding for installing new sidewalks, new storefronts. They'll actually open co-working spaces, some housing projects. They're actually doing a grocery store. So they had a bakery in Mount Oliver that was in business for 60 years.
Uh-huh.
The two ladies who ran the bakery retired. They had no one to give it to. So EDS said, you know what, this would be great if we could get another bakery in here. So we started to talk. We started to work on the business plan. I was working on my master's degree at the time. So my master's degree ended up becoming the business plan for the Bakery Society of Pittsburgh.
How neat.
Yeah, it kind of worked out that way.
Yeah.
So what we do, this is the only one around. We like to say, TBSP, we made it from scratch. So pardon the pun, but it's something we like to say.
Uh-huh.
We have a competition going on right now where you take 90 song lyrics and put some type of a bakery pun in it, and then you can win some prizes. We're going to be actually finishing that up at the end of the month and awarding those prizes. So what the Bakery Society of Pittsburgh does is we purchase this old Coleman's Bakery. We're completely revamping it. We're keeping the showroom, obviously. And we're going to have bakers come in three different levels. Level number one, we call the baker in residence. This is someone who is ready to open their own bakery, but they don't have maybe the money. They don't have everything they need to go. Maybe they don't have the business skills yet. So they come into our program as a baker in residence, and they work there for 18 months. Throughout that 18-month period, they get training from the Mansman Foundation and from EDS and from myself on everything from costing recipes, negotiating with suppliers, learning how to make other products that will augment their sales, the whole way up to writing their own business plan, marketing, working with bankers, to the ultimate goal at 18 months that they can go out and open their own business in whatever area they choose and be successful.
So it's kind of like the Smallman gallery.
I like to call this a pre-Smallman gallery.
Okay.
This is someone who isn't quite ready to take that step. They still need some work. So we work with them to get them up to maybe that level. They get paid 70% of everything they sell, plus we take 5% and put that in an escrow account. So if they sell a dollar cookie, 5% goes into an escrow account. When they graduate from the program in 18 months, that 5% has added up. They can use that for a down payment on a lease. They can use that for purchasing equipment, whatever. And CBSP does not charge equity. Once they leave, unlike some other places, they are the wholly owned business. We don't own any of their business after they leave. We made that decision early on, that it would be more fair to our bakers that way. So the second level of involvement is what we call tenant bakers. A tenant baker is someone who, hey, I'd really like to open a bakery, but I'm not there yet. I have a pretty good job. I'm not sure if this is really what I want to do. So the tenant baker can come in, and they can fulfill a need within my bakery. We can work together. They can buy their supplies through the bakery. We can work together to fill my shelves while still making them profitable. This allows them to get the feel of the bakery. It allows them to maybe work into a bakery in residence position because we're going to have new ones every quarter, and allows them to maybe say, is this for me, or maybe I just want to keep doing what I'm doing. And a perfect example of this is that lady, we all know who she is, who makes wedding cakes and who makes all the cookies for the cookie tables at weddings in Pittsburgh. She's making them out of her house right now. She doesn't have an approved kitchen. She doesn't have an inspected kitchen. We can do that. We can provide that for her. Plus, we can provide her with marketing assistance, branding assistance, website design, whatever she or he, in some cases, may need to develop their products. And then the third tier of involvement is the community baker. This is someone who maybe they own a restaurant now, but they just got an order to do 1,000 tacos. They need space. They need ovens. They can rent our space, come in, do what they have to do, clean up, and leave. Same thing with anyone. Anyone maybe wants to make apple pies for a farmer's market. They can come in, use our space, bring their own product, clean up, and leave. No muss, no fuss. Those are our three levels of involvement with the Bakery Society of Pittsburgh.
And the underwriting is the Hillman Foundation?
Yes. Matt Oliver graciously has allowed us to use the building and put us on a track to purchase the building. And the Hillman Foundation was the major underwriter. Yeah, they've been fantastic.
So now, my first question is, I mean, we really need all these bakers. I mean, is there a market for all these bakers?
Well, why not? I mean, Mount Oliver itself used to have three bakeries.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of new bakeries have opened up, I've noticed, in
Recent statistics are showing that people in the 25 to 34% age group, A, buy from a bakery 60% more often than any other age group, essentially because they're young and they can burn off the calories, I think. But B, this same age group, which is the new Mount Oliver demographic, by the way, is also started going back to the experts. They're going back, instead of going to a bar and ordering Jack Daniels, they're going to Wiggle Whiskey.
Yeah, that's
instead
true.
Of going to Church Brewworks and ordering a Budweiser, they're going to Church Brewworks and ordering something that they've made themselves. And we're starting to see this in the restaurant industry as well, as we're seeing these people are coming in and they want to go to the experts. They want to spend their money wisely and get a good quality meal, or in this case of the bakery, a good quality baked good.
Now, is there a built-in mission here that it's going to be a prototype that can be replicated across the country?
Well, we actually are looking at that right now. We're taking our business model now and working with someone to make the same type of a restaurant incubator for, you know, savory food. So, yeah, that's... wasn't my original intent, but that is a model that can be tweaked and taken out to other areas of the country. And really, we're looking at, you know, a profitable bakery. Obviously, you have to make a profit to keep the doors open, but we also want to be able to serve our community. I mean, Allegheny County has no recycling program for restaurants. We have a recycling program where we're going to take our things and then we're going to donate to that Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, Cub Scouts, whatever the case may be. Whoever will take it, and then they can make money off of it. Uh-huh. So community involvement and community support is really central to what we're doing at TBSP.
How many students, or how many, we don't call them students, how many people are involved in one of these three programs currently?
Well, we haven't opened yet. So our first, what we call cohort, our first big push will be 3 to 4 bakers in residence, and again, those are the people who are there for 18 months. And then tenant bakers, we could have 15 or 20 tenant bakers, each providing something specialized. We have a young lady who can do fondant in with a 3D printer for cakes, so that all someone has to do is just put it on the cake and they're done. She could come in and work, and then we could mail that. We could UPS that. We could sell that out of the bakery. Just one example. So we could have 15 or 20 tenant bakers. We could have maybe in any one time 5 or 10 community bakers over a weekend. So there are a lot of people who could be involved in this.
Do you have a lot of equipment? I mean, are you up to date? I mean, you're talking about 3D printers. They're not cheap.
No, and I don't have to supply that, luckily. But the young lady does have her 3D printer, and I'm glad you mentioned equipment. We're actually working with Construction Junction in Pittsburgh to purchase a really good quality used equipment that will then help, you know, Construction Junction. Some of the things we have to buy new. My stove, I have to have a new stove. I have to have a new freezer because I want things with warranties. But a lot of things we're buying through some of the suppliers around Pittsburgh, Construction Junction, so that we can save money, obviously, and help some of the people in the communities around. We have a very old 5-deck oven that works. Our walk-ins work, so that's handy. We're also working with one of the local colleges to have a wood-fired brick pizza oven designed and brought in and installed at TBSP.
Now, who's that?
That is Chatham College, and they're working with one of the local unions to actually design, build, and install the brick oven for us.
Wow, yeah. I'll tell you, that kitchen out at the Eden Hall campus is to die for, and I don't know that it gets all that use. I mean, it's too bad you can't do a program out of there.
I know. Well, the kitchen that I have now in the bakery showroom is on the first floor. The second floor is just office space and restrooms and the washer and dryer. The third floor is where the action happens. Luckily, the third floor is also accessible via a street behind the restaurant. So someone can come in right through the door on the third floor. We also have a garage door for deliveries. And I believe we are 110 feet long and 24 feet wide. So I have a very large space to work with.
Yeah, I mean, do you view it really, do you view your community as being local to you? I mean, or is it more citywide?
I think it's more citywide. Listen, if I have a high school kid from Mount Oliver who wants to come in and work in the showroom and maybe once has a passion for baking, I'm going to grab hold of that passion and get them upstairs onto the production floor. But we're also working with different agencies to get people into the bakery who have special needs that can still work in that type of an environment.
Well, you have a wide open agenda here. I mean, you must be having a good time, Phil.
I'm having a good time. I'm working an awful lot on the bakery, as well as, you know, the executive director and the EDS people and the marketing people. We're all working a lot. We were actually at a co-working space at Mount Oliver last night till about 7 o'clock hashing some of these things out. But it's a really super exciting project. And now the construction's undergoing, and we're starting to purchase equipment and get everything ready, it's even more exciting.
So where do people who might be interested, where do they find out more? There must be a point that you can send them to a URL or somewhere like that so that they can
absolutely
get in touch with you?
The webpage is tbspgh.com, and we also have the Bakery Society Pittsburgh Facebook page, and both of those link to one another so that if you get to tbspgh.com, you can get some information, and then you can go to our Facebook page and you can actually see pictures of some of our board of advisors. You can see pictures of the bakery. You can actually see some interviews that we've done and hear a webinar that we did Wednesday night, which explains, again, everything I've talked about today.
Well, it doesn't sense to me like you're not going to be bored, Phil.
You know what, Peter? I'm never bored, and my wife will attest to that, and I like to work, and I am really super passionate about this project. I mean, after 18 months, I better be, right?
Yeah, I guess so.
I should think so. So congratulations so far, and please keep us posted and let us know when you actually hit the ground running.
Thank you very much. I will do that. I'd love to have you come up and tour the space and be our guest.
Well, that sounds like fun, too. So we'll be in touch about that. And so,
yes. Phil, if you want, you can bring your roller skates. Because I've got a really long wooden floor. I always say I'm going to roller skate on it.
That sounds terrific. Well, I just hope it all comes to reality, to fruition. You have a lot of stuff to decide yet, I'm sure.
Oh, we do. Yeah, there's something. Emails flying every day.
Well, I thank you for taking the time to talk to us about it. And I'll be interested in you keeping us up to date on how everything develops.
I would love to keep you up to date. I will let you know when our opening gala is so that you can attend.
Great.
And I want to thank you very much for having me.
Well, I'm excited about it. So anyhow, it's good talking to you again, Phil.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, then, Peter. Goodbye.
Within a few months, TBSP is going to become a real reality. A real reality. There you go. There's a tautological statement.
Yeah, exactly.
But anyway.
Tautological. That's a nice word, too.
We'll be there at the opening. We'll bring you news of what it's really like. And until next week, same time, same place.
Bye-bye.